Hey guys, how's it going? I'm Ashton Cox, your host for the evening and every other evening that this show airs. Now what show, you might be asking? Well, what show other than The Chill Pill? The place where you can just sit back and relax. All right, now, as we did last show, we're going to be talking about stress. However, today, we will be talking to someone who has a profession which entails not only being knowledgeable about stress, but also teaching about the subject. She's been teaching introductory psychology along with behavioral neuroscience full-time at Pierce College for 12 years. I think it's time to talk to the one and only Professor Anne Hennessy. Don't you agree, Professor?
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah?
Yep.
I'd like to start with a fairly hard question just to get it out of the way.
Okay.
Just get it out of the way so that the rest of the questions are fairly easy.
Okay.
So let's just get right into it. How's your day going?
What was that? Pretty well. Yeah.
It's going pretty well?
A little wet, yeah.
It just started pouring today.
I know. I got a little wet coming over here, and that's fine. Yeah.
It's all right.
Yeah, absolutely. That was an easy question.
Fairly easy.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I want to get a better understanding of why you do what you do, you know, why you get up in the morning and you decide to walk into a classroom full of students and teach them all about psychology. So could you tell us why you became a psychology professor?
Yeah, so I came from, I'm from a small town in Massachusetts, and I went to a college, a small school in Maryland, Goucher College, and I had fallen in love with psychology even before I went to college, but when I was in college, I did some teaching, like a TA position within some labs, and I did 2 years of research, and I fell in love with research, and so since I liked, you know, the personal experience of being at a college, being from a small town, I think, in part, and my falling in love with research, I ended up deciding to go and get a PhD with the intention to teach at a four-year college, which I did. I used to teach at Smith College, which is in Massachusetts, but it wasn't a tenure-track position. And in the middle of it, I decided I didn't want to do any more research, because neuroscience research involves sacrificing animals for a living.
Oh,
and
really?
I actually love animals, so it was really hard. And so I decided not to do that, and I quit, and I missed teaching. I didn't miss the research. And then I moved to California from the East Coast, and people told me, oh, well, you can still teach and not do research at a community college, which I didn't know that. So I was like, okay, let me try it. And I applied to Pierce, got the position. They were looking for a behavioral neuroscience person with a behavioral neuroscience background to help create the lab that goes with the Psych 2 course, which is behavioral neuroscience. And given all my research experience and lots of teaching experience, I got hired. And I just love being in the classroom where it's a dynamic experience. I learn as much from the students as they probably learned from me, and that just gives me a lot of joy. So I really enjoy it.
And were you teaching, you were teaching in Maryland before? Or?
No, well, I was teaching as an undergrad, just teaching, like, helping out in labs.
Oh, so like but, volunteer work,
yeah,
stuff like that?
Yeah, yeah. So the classes that I had previously taken, I was helping out with them. And then once I got excited about research, I knew I'd be fine going to grad school because I had already done a lot of research as an undergrad, which is the way that you know that you have a passion for research.
Yeah.
Is you take it and you like it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, what did it take for you to make it to the place that you're at now?
To get a PhD, which you don't need to teach at a two-year school, but on the way of getting a PhD, it's really a perseverance degree. You don't have to be that smart necessarily, but you have to start something and finish it.
Okay.
So I have great grit. Yeah. Determination, perseverance.
Gotcha.
That's really what's important. And then I think teaching at a school like here, where there's so much diversity in terms of preparedness and everything else, you have to be a very flexible person. And so I'd say another factor that's really helped me is I'm a long-term meditator, and so I've been meditating for 20 years. So that's part of the joyfulness that I have, that people are like, that's a little weird.
We could definitely talk about that, because that definitely entails stress.
Oh, definitely.
Definitely entails stress.
Definitely helps to reduce stress,
multiple
levels.
We'll come back to that.
Okay.
So meditation.
Meditation has helped me to be here and enjoy it.
Yes. Now, what obstacles did you face while pursuing your career?
Well, none other than being a little disappointed that I took this trajectory amongst on a path that I ended up saying no to. Mm. That was kind of a big deal, but that was totally my choice. I actually got a tenure position, tenure track position. I was offered one and I turned them down and just stayed in my grant supported position at Smith, where I was teaching full time before this. And then so it was completely my choice. And then what was funny is it was hard to get hired for anything else than being a professor at a university or college. And so I explored actually working with I specialized working with one child with autism for 3 years. And I learned a lot in that kind of position. You know, I actually physically went to the person's home, and then I worked one-on-one doing behavioral therapy, and that was kind of fun.
How did behavioral therapy with that child work? Like, what did you exactly do?
So what you end up doing is you're teaching them different life skills to a great extent and also some cognitive abilities, but mostly teaching them how to stay on target, to start and complete a task, and if they have any kind of emotional volatility, to just be kind of chill with it and not respond too intensely, you know, just be like redirect as much as possible. And it turns out that I was really compatible with the child that I worked with.
And, that's excellent.
Timmy. And it was great. We just got along really fine. And it was really actually very fun. But I went home for 2 years after that, back to Massachusetts. My parents were having some health issues. Mm. And so then when I moved back to California, I was like, well, I should probably be a professional again at a higher level. And that's when I found out about teaching without doing research. And that's how I applied here. And it was easy because I applied and got the position. So there wasn't much of an obstacle there.
There you go. Now, do you remember the first class that you ever taught about psychology?
So intro psych class at, you know, besides what I did as an undergrad, but at Smith College, which was, it's a top 20 school and it's a women's college. And it's the way they teach intro psych is they have it a team taught approach. So five faculty are teaching together, like 200 kids at once.
Is that what the team taught?
Yeah, that's the way they, you know, operationally define team taught. Okay. Everyone was teaching their expertise. And then we'd have a couple sections where we'd work with students in a smaller group. So then I get to know about 25 students in different sections. And we would do the grading for just those students in our, like, discussion section. Okay. But we get to meet, you know, all 200 students at once. And then we get to collaborate with one another. And then we come up with questions for our part that we were communicating. So what was really great about that is that I was hearing how experts with different PhDs and different expertise, with different expertise and different subdisciplines of psychology, how they would communicate about it. Mm. So that's really helped me to teach here because I got a great education with people that really knew what they were talking about and how they prioritized what they would communicate. And that's what I learned by being part of that team. And then I learned it well enough to be able to teach it to my discussion groups. And now I'm just, you know, solo act here when I teach intro psych. But I do teach a double, which is 100 people at once, which is kind of interesting because when I was at a four-year school, I loved the seminars, which are like 12 people.
Mm. And you teach 100 people now?
Like, yeah, in one class.
Is it the one
that you showed up for, right, for the intro psych? It's in a double room. It's in a room that's like stadium seating. So the behavioral science 13. Oh, you came to the psych too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you come to psych too? Oh, so that's in the smaller rooms. Yeah, that's right. Okay, but you hadn't had psych one yet, right?
No.
So you couldn't be in the. Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Okay. When I was doing my schedule. I took a picture of the computer when I had your class on it.
Right.
But then I realized I had to drop classes.
Right.
And I didn't update the picture, so I went to your class the first day.
I remember.
Completely missed Professor Jill Cohen's class.
Who you're taking now.
Yeah. And
Right.
But, yeah.
So Psych 1, which is introductory psych here, is a prerequisite for Psych 2. So Psych 2 in our department is the only class that's a 200 level. So it's like a sophomore level. So both Psych 1 and Psych 2 are transfer level, but Psych 2 is one where people definitely know they're going to transfer or they wouldn't be taking the class.
Okay.
There's very few people who just take it for fun.
If I just continued to be in that class, that would just be funny.
That would be really funny.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun teaching those students. It's very different than teaching the intro psych students who are just so diverse. And a lot of people will never take another psych class. At least these students have taken Psych 1 and they're now enrolled in Psych 2. So I really like the diversity of teaching the Psych 1 students, and I do a double section, so two sections of that each semester, and then I do three different sections of Psych 2, which is fun because I go in there and it's like there are different life experiences, even while I'm teaching exactly the same material, but to different groups of students. And so sometimes I'm like, well, it's like I wasn't even teaching the same thing, but I was. The foundational information is the same, but the dynamic's really different. And that's what keeps me enjoying teaching here, the students. And just that you never know how a class is going to go, you know, and what's going to happen in the class, what kind of questions come up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, like, have you ever, like, felt overwhelmed, like, with the amount of students that you'd have to be teaching at a time?
Well, not the students. What overwhelms me is the grading. Associated with
that's
students.
What I always think. I mean, I see professors with multiple classes, and I'm just like, how are you doing this?
So when I was at Smith, when I was teaching at a, you know, a four-year school, I taught five classes a year because I was doing research as well and even some pre-major advising and major advising. But here you teach, as a full-time faculty, five courses a semester. So I teach, you know, basically, you know, in the fall and the spring, and then I also teach in the summer two classes. So I teach, it used to be more students, but, you know, I teach about 200 a semester, and then in the summer another 100, so it's like 500 kids a year. So
now I'm starting
to
realize why you're meditating.
And then
now I realize why you meditate.
Right, right. And a long-term goal I have before I retire, and I hope to retire within the next 10 years, is to create a consciousness course before I leave. And teach it here. And then when I retire, I want to teach that just to people in general.
What would that course entail?
Well, I have a vision of having it be integrated of an integration of psychology, neuroscience, behavioral neuroscience, and mostly Buddhist type approaches to meditation, but also I do transcendental meditation, so also mantra-based meditation. And I'm particularly interested in introducing to people something that hasn't made it that much in the West, which is like heart practices.
Okay.
So ways to be, a new term is for that is like kindfulness. So to be mindfully kind.
Okay.
You know, and I think that's much needed because the U.S. has taken, and the West in general, has adopted a lot of Buddhist mindfulness practices. But mindfulness without an open heart doesn't really improve life on a global level, maybe an individual level, but not like systematically.
You're just trying to teach it like so that someone can see it through the whole picture.
Yeah.
The whole picture.
Yeah. So I imagine I think it's important for everyone to learn about consciousness and also to learn how if they want to alter their consciousness through ancient practices where there's a lot of now scientific data that suggests that it works, how they might, you know, pursue that. So kind of give them a broad perspective. If they want to go through it through the psych angle or the neuroscience angle or more philosophy, it should approach, you know, it'd be an approach that I would kind of open up to them.
It's quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now that we've gotten to know you pretty well, let's get right into it. Let's talk about stress now.
Yeah,
so
okay.
What would you say are the most common forms of stress?
Well, the way I like to teach about stress is for people to comprehend that stress can affect you at four different levels.
Okay.
So if anyone wanted to know personally if they're stressed or someone else is stressed or someone's doing any kind of research relating to it, they can look at you, get evidence from your physiology, right? It could be something as simple as so physical symptoms of stress. They could just check out your blood pressure, your heart rate, your breath rate. They could look at your sympathetic nervous system activation, your immune system activation, decreased activation of your parasympathetic nervous system. They could check out like cortisol levels, right? They could look in different brain regions and see what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so those will be like physical aspects of stress.
So the first form is the physical.
Well, that's just it. I could do them in any order, but that's usually how about it. Yeah. So one aspect of stress is how it affects you physiologically, how it affects you physically. And then another way is how it affects you in your mind. And these are all interrelated, right? But like how it affects you cognitively. So how is it that your mind might change the way you're mentally processing information, which would be indicative of stress? So might look at, you know, how well are you remembering? How well are you concentrating? How well are you able to be present to what's going on, to be aware, to be alert, right? What's your sense of humor like? Has it changed? Has it decreased, right? Do you tend to do what is called catastrophizing, which is you basically think the worst possible thing will happen given that you're so stressed? And you might not think that way if you're not stressed. There are some people who catastrophize all the time. But if you as an individual do not do that typically, but now you're doing it, that's a sign for you that you're kind of stressed, right? And if usually you think everything's funny and you haven't even laughed today, that's a sign that you're stressed, right? And so that's kind of about how you're processing information mentally. And then you can look at how someone is feeling or what they're, how they're emotional, right? So are they more frustrated? Are they more angry? Are they more, let's see, what are some other things? More anxious? Do they tend to be more critical of other people, right? Are they more impulsive, maybe taking more risks? Right. So that's kind of more related to emotional aspects, but it can relate to everything. And then in terms of there's some that can cut across categories. So like with sleep, physically, you might be not sleeping as much.
I've noticed that.
Yeah. Yes. Cognitively, because if you're not getting like slow wave sleep, deep sleep, then you're not remembering facts as well. Right. And then emotionally, that could be expressed the same aspect. Sleep could be expressed in terms of nightmares. Right. OK, so you got to sleep. You got to REM sleep. But now you have this horrific dream that you recall in story like form. That's very visual. A monster was coming after you. Right. That kind of thing. And then the next one would be looking at stress, how it affects someone behaviorally. How does their behavior change when they're stressed? So a lot of those changes are like avoidance, procrastination, right? Just not doing what it is that's making you stressed, right? And then maybe there's some things that you normally do that decrease your stress and you're not doing them as well, right? So you're not exercising or you're not socializing as much. All those kind of changes, those are like behavioral changes. And then the good news is that if you are able to be aware that that's happening for you, then you know that you're stressed and you know that you should do something about stress. So then we talk about ways to target different levels of stress. You may decide to have a strategy that is targeting the physical levels. That's going to have ramifications for the other three levels, right? Or you could take a cognitive approach, but then you're changing your cognitions can change your physiology, which can change your behavior and change your emotional processing.
Wow.
So then we go through the ideas. And what I do when I teach intro psych one is I get people to write an essay. From one essay's option usually for each chapter. And the one on stress, a lot of people do because they understand it. Mm-hmm. They're like, I've been
stressed. Everybody can relate to
Everyone can relate to stress. And then they write about how, like, three different ways that they affect you, stress affects you at each of those four levels just mentioned, and how does it affect you physically, cognitively, emotionally, and behaviorally. And then what are some approaches for those targeting stress at all four levels. So you could learn how to meditate, for instance, right? Could change your physiology, could change the way you think, could change the way you feel. And it's a change in behavior if you weren't meditating before, right? You could learn breath work. You could do all kinds of things. So what's really cool about it is if you just break it down in that simple way, those four different ways of experiencing stress, you automatically, implicitly know that there's approaches that can work at each of those four levels. And because they're so interconnected, affecting decreasing stress at any of those levels decreases stress at all levels, which is great.
Well, you just mentioned meditation, so I might as well get right into it. But when did you start meditating? Like, when did you adapt?
What's interesting is I had a professional magician who happened to be a transcendental meditation teacher come to Smith College when I was teaching there. Right at the time, I decided to quit teaching after I was done with my stint at Pierce.
Okay.
I mean, at Pierce, at Smith.
Yeah.
And he came to do a performance at our end of the year science celebration, right? Sigma Xi celebration. And then I talked to him afterwards because he was going to come to a summer course I was teaching for kids that were high school students that are exploring what it's like to be at college. So I was teaching a sensation and perception course. And so he was going to be an invited speaker for that course. And so we talked after, you know, this performance he did for the science community. And then we happened to be talking about meditation because that's what he does. And I'm like, oh, you know, I've heard of that before, but I wasn't that interested. He goes, what do you mean you're not interested? They publish in the same, you know, scientific journals that you publish, have published in, or that you read in. And then he brought up actually a study at UCLA that was done at UCLA, published in Science, which was one of the first papers that documented that you can intentionally do something like meditation to change your neurophysiology. Well, at that point, it was just physiology. And now they know it changes your brain as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's how I got interested. I read some papers. And then a couple weeks later, I learned.
What do you exactly do? Like, walk me through a session.
Okay. So my main meditation is called Transcendental Meditation. And you repeat in your mind without intentionally doing it after you get practice what's called a mantra. So a word that is often given to you by the teacher that you're supposed to keep private. So I'll just use a different word, mm-hmm. But like usually a Sanskrit word from ancient India. So like Om, you've probably heard of the Om, the sound Erd Om, yeah. Right? So the idea is the practice initially is just 20 minutes twice a day, and it's eyes closed meditation. And so you're sitting there with your eyes closed and you're intending to have that sound of Om come to your mind. And when you notice it's not coming to your mind, that means your mind is doing something else.
Wait, so you're not supposed to actually do Om?
No. You're just, you don't know. You can do, that's another form of meditation. You can do chanting.
Okay.
And that can work. That's really powerful. I also love that, but that's not my main practice. Yeah. Mm. So the mantra-based meditation is a way for you to use that Om to transcend your thought. That's why it's called transcendental meditation. Mm. So the idea is when your mind is not on the Om, that means you're having some thoughts. And it's fine to be having thoughts or emotions or feelings, right? But the idea is that allows you to notice that you're not having, not on the Om, so you come back to the Om. And every time you come back to it, so you're like thinking the Om, and then something else is happening, and then you come back to the Om. And you keep practicing that. And what happens over time is that that kind of energy that you get into the gap. That's one of the ways of talking about it. You get into the space between the Om and between the thoughts and sensations and feelings. Mm. And that is a place of like utter stillness. And it gives your brain a sense of rest that's even deeper than sleep. So it's like a really amazing thing. And then really? What happens over time is you end up being able to manifest that quality when you're not meditating. So it's like you're kind of, so I tend to be more joyful than other people just naturally, but in part because I'm kind of like having a moving meditation at all times, right? So I'm kind of in this state of really high level of calm, but also really alert. So kind of a restful alertness, if that even makes any sense.
That makes sense.
And then it's much easier to do everything in your life. So the idea is that life is a little bit more effortless than it would be if you hadn't been meditating. And then what was kind of funny is that after I learned, most of my friends were neuroscientists or scientists, and they couldn't figure out. They knew I was different, but they would never think about this, right? Mm. So they noticed a difference. And my parents especially, people have known me my whole life, noticed I was really different. And they learned to meditate after that. Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to switch gears really quickly. One last question.
Sure.
Would you say that stress comes in only forms of like bad, or are there any good forms
of
stress?
Okay, so you can think about stress on a continuum, and there's something called eustress, which is an optimal level of excitation that's actually good. So if you find something challenging and you're not identifying it as a threat, it can actually help you to be more successful. So say someone in athletic performance or taking a test, if you prepared for the test effectively and you're intelligent and critically thinking while you're taking a test, it could be a good life experience. At the opposite end is the catastrophes, and then closer to the eustress would be just daily life hassles, like it's you can't find parking, right? Mm. And then you can have real life changes, like significant life changes, meaningful life changes, like graduation. That's a great thing, but it can be stressful. So it's kind of like it's a continuum of stress possibilities.
It seems like everything that you just told me, like relating to stress, it's really on the individual. It's really just up to them to kind of change how they, how they handle it.
Right. I would agree with that, you know. But sometimes you need to increase your awareness of when you are stressed versus when you're not stressed to be able to initiate that change. Mm. But the good news is that there's so many different techniques to reduce stress. And one of the best scientifically, you know, evidenced practices is many different kinds of meditation.
So you would recommend meditation?
Highly recommend it. Either transcendental meditation or mindfulness meditation or martial arts, certain martial arts, especially Tai Chi, Qigong, you know, or chanting, music, certain kinds of music. Yeah, there's all kinds of possibilities. But that's what's great. There's so many options.
Awesome. Well, we are done here for the day. A huge thanks to Professor Hennessy for choosing this show as her number one priority for today at 2 o'clock. Thank you for filling our brains with a whole smorgasbord of information. I am your host, Ashton Cox, and this was The Chill Pill, the place where you can just sit back and relax. Bye-bye.